The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Eric Stuckstad, managing editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about alcohol and risky behavior. Eric, what's the story all about?
This story's about the impact that adolescent drinking has on risk-taking or risky behavior throughout life. It's known that teenagers who drink more tend to grow up into adults who drink more as adults and who participate in more risky behavior. The problem is nailing down cause and effect there. So that means, is it drinking that makes you likely to take risky behavior, or is it people who would engage in risky behaviors throughout their life just tend to like to drink as teenagers? So how do you figure out what's causing what? What these researchers did was they turned to rats, and they turned to rats because they could have them be genetically identical. So that rules out any kind of genetic variation between the rats. The rats, they divided into two groups. One didn't get any alcohol, and the others drank pretty much multiple drinks every day.
By choice, what would cause a rat to want to drink some alcohol?
Rats don't actually like to drink, but they got these rats to do that by spiking gelatin. So the rats were interested in the gelatin and ended up consuming the alcohol.
So they had jello shots.
Exactly.
Okay. How did they test then for risk-taking among these jello-shooting rats?
Yeah, they had to kind of do a proxy for that as well. This was one of those classic press-the-lever tests. It's essentially a gambling situation where instead of a slot machine, they had two levers and they could press one or the other. And the system was set up so if they pressed one lever, they might get a food reward every time. That's a pretty non-risky situation. Press a lever, get a treat. The other lever might not give them a treat, but occasionally they get the big ka-ching payoff and get more food. So the question is, do they engage in pressing the risky lever or not? And it turned out that the rats that were drinking, as young rats, they liked the risky lever. What's interesting is that after the drinking stopped, for the rest of their lives, they still liked to gamble for the big food payoff.
So almost as if the early exposure to alcohol changed something about how they behaved.
Exactly. Now, the question, of course, the big question here is, can you extrapolate that to humans? Because the human brain is obviously more complex than the rat brain. Not entirely clear yet, but other researchers say this is really fairly strong evidence that, yes, alcohol really does seem to have a significant impact on the developing brain.
Okay, well, thanks, Eric. So what other stories have we brought with you this week?
So let's move from alcohol to ethanol.
Another alcohol.
But this is ethanol, and it's ethanol in the context of energy policy, biofuels. In 2007, the U.S. Congress passed a law that set a target of 36 billion gallons of biofuels that the country would produce by 2022. Now, of that, 15 billion is slated to come from corn-based ethanol. Now, the catch with biofuels is that if you make them out of corn or plants that you're growing on farm fields, then that has other environmental impacts. One big one is that when fertilizer washes off of farm fields in the Midwest, it goes down the Mississippi and into the Gulf of Mexico. That nitrogen and phosphorus has a really damaging effect there.
But this isn't just true for biofuels. This is true for any kind of farming activity, right?
That's right. But if you create incentives for farmers to grow corn so that it'll be made into ethanol, then you tend to get more crops grown as corn. And corn requires a lot of fertilizer. What that means for the Gulf of Mexico is that when that nitrogen and phosphorus ends up in those waters, it feeds algae and bacteria. When the algae and bacterial blooms die, they sink, they decompose, and when they decompose, that pulls oxygen out of the water, suffocating fish, crabs, other life that people like to fish and eat. So already the Gulf of Mexico has large dead zones. So one question was whether producing those 15 billion gallons of ethanol from corn would increase the size of the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. And it's clear from previous research that that is the case. Now, the next question was whether if you produced more or all of the target for biofuels from cellulosic ethanol, whether that would lead to a smaller dead zone. Now, cellulosic ethanol. That you can do with more of the corn plant, including the rest of the plant, not just the corn, and with other plants. So you can really use less fertilizer if you're doing cellulosic ethanol. What they found was you still need nitrogen and other fertilizers to create enough plants to do cellulosic ethanol with. So there would still be a big spike of nutrients flowing into the Gulf, and that the dead zone will in fact increase, even if we meet that biofuels target by only using cellulosic ethanol.
So last one, what's this last story about?
Well, keeping with agriculture, some of the most fertile farm fields in the world are on deltas, and new research is showing that deltas all over the world are starting to sink.
Everywhere?
That's really the new part of this study, is that it took a global look and compiled data from satellite images. They looked at computer models, they looked at how much sediment is flowing down rivers, and took a look at 33 deltas all over the world. And the surprising number is that 28 of those are essentially losing their race with the sea.
So what does it exactly mean for a delta to sink?
Well, in one sense, deltas are always sinking, because the way a delta is built is that when a major river empties its water out to the sea, it's also carrying sediment. And that sediment gets deposited near the mouth of the river, building up a bank of sand until it actually reaches the surface of the water, and then plants grow, and the whole delta can, by that increase of sediment and vegetation, it can reach sea level. At the same time, that seafloor is subsiding, it's going down, and the sediments themselves, under their own weight, are compacting. So there's this essentially a race for the level of the delta to keep up with sea level. And to make it even a little more complicated, sea level itself changes. So with global warming, for example, as glaciers melt, there's more water entering the oceans, sea level goes up, and as sea level goes up, those deltas tend to get flooded. So what this study found was that deltas are now sinking relative to sea level, and that ranged all the way up to 60 millimeters a year for the Po Delta in Italy.
So global warming is having an impact. Is that the only thing that humans do that caused deltas to sink?
Yeah, in addition to human-caused global warming, there are two other big impacts that humans are having locally on deltas. One is when you drill for oil or drill for natural gas and you pull that out of the sediments in the delta, that causes them to compact even further. So you really exacerbate the compaction and the sinking of the delta. The other one is a little further upstream, and that's the engineering of rivers, which we've done a lot of. So build a dam on a river, and you not only hold back water, you hold back the sediment that's flowing down the river. The sediment gets trapped behind the dams. The deltas then get starved of that sediment that they use to build themselves up with. And in fact, right now, that impact from oil and gas extraction and from starving the deltas of sediment, that's the larger impact that humans are having. Who knows, if global warming keeps going, whether that might change.
Okay, well, thanks, Eric.
Good to be here, Rob.
Eric Stockstead is managing editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.